Well, I'm David Alkeck, past president.
Your mic.
Let's see, where's the mic?
Over there.
Over there.
Over there. There you go.
Okay. And so welcome to the Dallas Philosophers Forum. We've been around...
78.
Since 1978, we're writing a history of this organization. So may I ask, are there any new attendees, people who haven't been here before?
Over there.
Yes.
Visitor from Denver.
Oh, well, welcome. And you can come back, of course.
Thank you.
The Dallas Philosophers Forum, as you know, started out with academic philosophers, but we expanded our curriculum. We talk about all kinds of things: history, science. We've had the poet laureate of Oklahoma talk to us. Yeah. Beauty, art, all kinds of things. A few little messages. If you haven't paid your admission fee of $5 to our treasurer, David, from there, and if you're a full-time student, it's only $2. make sure you take care of your bill if you have food or drinks. We don't like to be stuck with your bill because we can't afford it. Take care of your waiter, please. Let's see, what else?
Cell phones.
Yeah, take your cell phones off. Welcome, Jerry. tonight we have Brian Reed with us. We also have coming up... the Changing Political Landscape with Dr. Bradley Carter, Emergence and the Science of Miracles by Dr. Paul Tobolowsky, The Nature of Use and Abuse of Human Conceptual Systems by Wynn Galbraith, and The Philosophy of Ancient India.
Yeah,
thank you. That was last fall, that's right.
That's what's up.
It's yellow.
Yeah. All right. We have next meeting speaker back here if anybody wants to talk to him after.
Jeff Levine.
Yes.
Okay. On denialism. I'm sorry. Compassion and the Value of the 21st Century by Charlie Barker. Free Will and Determinism. I don't know if we have a choice, do we? David Krishner. The Fragility of Life and the Meaningless of Existence. Mystic Voices, Religious, Beauty, and the City, and the Philosophy of Energy. Okay, so tonight we have with us Dr. Brian Rigg, PhD. He was born in Arlington, Texas. It actually had people back then? He attended Yale University and graduated with honors. Majored in history, German studies, and English. English as a second language? No. Yale awarded him the Henry Fellowship to attend Cambridge, where he attended, and received his master's and then his PhD from Cambridge. He's written 4 books on World War II and the Holocaust. I think he's going to talk about those. You're going to mention those. His first work won him the William E. Kobe Award for the Best Military History of 2002 for a first-time author. He's been on numerous TV and radio shows, and he also served as an officer in the U.S. Marine Corps and as a volunteer in the Israeli Army. He has his own financial advisory firm, Rigg Wealth Management, and he is the proud single father of 3 wonderful children, lives here in Dallas. He's been on the faculty of SMU and the American Military University, where he taught military history, military philosophy, the Holocaust, and the history of God. He was scheduled to give this talk last year, as I read it, but he had to reschedule that appearance because he was honored in Germany. He had to go to Germany to receive the Konrad Adenauer Award for his service as a board member of the Romer Institute and his work on the Holocaust and human rights in Europe. I could go on and on about his achievements and honors, but I will let him speak for himself. Will you help me welcome Brian Brady?
Oh, thanks, David. Is this on?
It's on, you're on.
Okay. Thanks, Doc.
You're welcome. Good luck.
I appreciate it. So, when my dear friend, Dr. Alkek, invited me to come and speak to you, and we talked about topics to discuss, he said, well, why don't you talk about, you know, the history or the process of finding truth, finding knowledge? And I've never spoken about that, although that's been my whole goal in life, writing my 4, soon to be 5 books. And so I've been thinking an awful lot about how to address you and what I'm going to be discussing tonight, especially how you find truth. And I'm about as interested as you are to hear what I'm about to say. Because it's been a process. And the one thing I wanted to lead off with, and there's an interesting story here. I was blessed to study underneath one of the most foremost brilliant scholars of German history, Henry Ashby Turner Jr., the second, obviously, at Yale University. And he was very big hammering me with, through the process of empiricism, you figure out the stuff. You go into it, you let the evidence lead you to your conclusions. You don't have a particular vision and then try to find the evidence to support it, which a lot of people do. And that's there was a famous historian, I hate to call him a historian, most people historians don't consider him a historian, his name is Daniel Goldhagen. He wrote Hitler's Willing Executioners back in 1995 and became a world sensation really in Germany. It's almost like the self-flagellation concept in Germany. It basically was saying there was something inherent in the German genes, German culture, if you will, that led it to the extermination policies that we saw in Nazi Germany. A totally bogus thesis. But what he did is he went around and he found evidence to kind of support that instead of looking at the evidence and letting him come to a different conclusion, which most Holocaust historians have. What happened in Nazi Germany, unfortunately, is part of the fabric of mankind. You know, being a historian, I don't have the luxury to be optimistic about mankind. And genocide has been part of our DNA since time immemorial. In fact, it was glorified in the Old Testament, you know, of taking out, or God taking out whole cultures with the flood, and then you get to the Amalekites and the Midianites and so on. And then, of course, you know, as Hitler said, when people were confronting him with his genocide against the Jews, he said, you know, who remembers the Armenian genocide? Who cares? And we could even further go nowadays. We knew about the modern genocide in Rwanda, but what did you do? You know, what can you do? But the other question that you could ask is, probably should have done more, shouldn't you? Yeah. So, and we had the problem in Bosnia and, of course, Sudan. And, you know, granted, America, I love what Churchill said. After exhausting all other opportunities, America usually does the right thing. And, you know, we stopped Hirohito, we stopped Hitler in World War II, two of the worst regimes that I can imagine. Out there. I mean, Mao taught them, but that's a whole other story. But, you know, we did go into Bosnia. We were late there, try to secure things. We did go into Kosovo, you know, protecting Muslim nations, if you will, or Muslim people. And so we do more than most nations throughout history to try to stop this, but we still have a long way to go. Now getting back to Henry Turner. So he told me, through the process of empiricism, you need to really use that to come to your conclusions, writing your essays about history and so on. So that was my first client. He was such a beat down of a professor. I mean, he was brutal to his students. He was a brilliant scholar. He was a horrible leader, if you will. A great instructor, but he didn't inspire you. He's one of those kind of old school, you know, if you find a way to demoralize your kid and he still comes back, that's when he's a good student, so to speak. I kind of have two souls in my breast. On one side, he taught me how to be a very good historian. On another side, he was a very mean person, you know. But this is what I'm getting to. Practice what you preach as a teacher is one of the golden rules if you can. And a lot of times you preach what you need to hear. And I don't think he was doing it in some respects with the following story. So I take his class and I go off to Europe in 1992 to research my family's background. The wall had come down in 1989 and most of my family came from the communist sections of Germany. Prussia now was open to me. Obviously, it's Poland and Russia now, Prussia. But Saxony, which was East Germany, DDR, that was where a lot of my family came from. And Brandenburg, which a lot of that was Eastern Germany as well. So I went over there and I started researching my family's background in 1992. And during the process of just wanting to know where my family came from, where they were born, where they were buried, what professions they had, and I went to three major cities, or towns, I should say, and I ended up going to the courthouses, and by the end of this summer, I had traced 2,000 names in my family tree, back to the 1600s. And next to a lot of the names, there was always the religion in Germany, this kind of interesting side jump of German history. But since 1648, almost every birth, marriage, death in Germany was documented with the religion that you were. Because in the 30 Years' War from 1618 to 1648, there was a lot of fratricide. You know, Gustav Adolphus, Protestant troops would go into what they thought was a Catholic town, kill everybody, and then later on find out they were Protestants. So what the different provinces in Germany started doing is like, you know what, if we had better documentation, we would have known who to kill. And we know who we could trust, so you actually had this obsession in German lands to always document Catholic or Protestant. Well, as I'm going through my family tree, I'm not seeing Katholisch, and I'm not seeing Evangelisch, I'm seeing Mozarisch and Hebraisch, the religion of the Mosaic religion, the religion of Moses, or the religion of Hebrew, the Hebrew religion. And I was like, man, I never knew this, you know, and I came back to Yale, and I went to the Hillel there, the Jewish Student Center, and I sat down with all my papers, and a rabbi came over, and he started mapping out my papers, and it comes down to my mother's line, my mother and grandmother. And he got all excited, and he said, Baruch Hashem, blessed be God, you're a Jew. And I said, well, what does that mean? I always thought I was a wasp. And he explained halakha, Jewish halakha, and he said, you are, according to the ancient Jewish code of citizenship, since it comes down to your mother's line, you're Jewish. And I got a scholarship and went to Israel and learned a lot about my Jewish background. But what was interesting about this with my mind, speaking of it being a historian, is I had a great uncle that was a doughboy in World War I. And he, as most American boys are, was obsessed with souvenirs. And he would take medals and stuff off of dead Germans. And one dead German he took a diary off of, and he was interested in it because the guy had the same last name that he had, Barbie with a Y. Totally different than Barbie with an IE. Many of you who know about Klaus Barbie, he was a Huguenot. His family had been persecuted because they were Protestants, went to Germany, and then, you know, four generations later, Klaus Barbie is one of the worst, you know, Nazis of World War II, but his name was originally Barbier. So no relation. Barbie, my family comes from the fish called Barsch. It's on the Rhine. It's a little town called Barbie because they fish the Barsch, and they just kind of think, okay, we're Barbies. We get the Barsch fish. So I come from the ancient tradition of being a fisherman. So he found his diary of this German, same last name as him, Barbie, it's a unique German name, that's where people have it, brought it back to my great-grandfather. My great-grandfather read it and said, yeah, this is my uncle's kid. So he found his cousin. Now, I mean, we had a lot of stories because of the Civil War and so on, but what started playing in my mind is, okay, now if all these guys are Jewish, this guy was serving in the German military in World War I, and he could fight for the fatherland and die, what would have happened to him had he survived? Well, you know, he would have died 20, 30 years later. You know, and I started thinking to myself, what would have happened to me? So part of history also is kind of asking that question, who am I? What does it mean to be human? What is it? What is identity? Also during this summer, I saw the movie Europa Europa. And if you haven't seen it, it's on Netflix. It's a pretty interesting film. It's about a Jew, Shlomo Perel, who leaves Germany in 1936 due to Nazi persecution. And he goes to Poland. In 1939, when Germany invades Poland, he goes to Russia. In 1941, when Germany invades Russia, he can't escape anymore. He's captured outside of Minsk. And he tells his captors, hey, I'm a Volksdeutscher. I'm an ethnic German. His testimony was accepted, and since he spoke Polish, Russian, and German, they brought him into the military unit as their translator, Dolmetscher. And he stayed there as a 15-year-old kid for a whole year until his company commander, Captain von Munchau, decides to adopt him and send him back to a Hitler youth prep school where he survived the war. Now I'm watching this film in Germany. I'm the only one really in this theater in Berlin, off of Kurfürstendamm, the main strand. And before the film began, an old man had walked in, and it was dim, and his eyes hadn't adjusted to the darkness. And he was discombobulated. He kind of leaned up against the wall. So with my Texas upbringing, I jumped up, you know, went to him and said, hey, can I help you find a seat, sir? And he was very appreciative, sat him down. He quickly heard my German was not very good, started speaking English to me. And since he spoke fluent British English, he said, if you have any questions during the film, just ask. And so he basically translated the entire dialogue. And he was telling, this is a war film, so he said, oh, that happened, oh, that didn't happen, this is how we did things. He's giving me all this commentary, and at the end of the film, he's in tears. It's a very touching way that the film ends. And I asked him, you know, would you like to go talk about this? And he's like, yeah, this is very close to my own history. So he went to a bar, and for the whole night, he told me his story. He was of Jewish descent and served in the Nazi military and had survived that way. He was in a Russian prisoner of war camp, lost his brother outside of Leningrad, was horrified about what was going to happen to his mother. And at the end of the night, out on the streets of Berlin, where nobody was there, probably 3 or 4 in the morning, I gave him a big hug and I told him, I will not forget you. So I came back to Yale and I sat down with Henry Turner, who had taught me German history and empiricism. I said, yeah, I don't think this is a coincidence. You know, I don't think there's a God up there, you know, pushing the buttons, telling me to do this. But I think there is something about destiny here that I find out about my own Jewish background, find out about, you know, this guy that my uncle found in World War I was a cousin, but they were Jewish. And then I find out about this guy in the film who was a Jew in the Nazi military, only sit next to a guy of Jewish descent, a German Nazi military. There must have been more of these guys. He says, stop, you're not going to find anything. I've studied it for 40 years. I was like, well, have you ever looked into it? He said, no. I said, do you know anybody who's ever looked into it? He said, no. I was like, okay, we'll see. So almost on a dare, I started looking into this. So I used the Nexus search. That was kind of a big thing back then that was kind of putting newspapers together. And I slowly but surely, that year, I found 20 people of Jewish descent who had served in the Nazi military. So I took off a year between my junior and senior year to go interview these people before they died. All my professors told me not to. They were saying, hey, you know, we've had a lot of kids that have left college, they never come back, you know, get your degree, quit studying. I quote you from a letter, because it haunted me, from Henry Turner. Quit studying some curious anomalies will not add anything to our understanding of the Third Reich and study some serious German history. So I said, hey, I'm going to go see what I find. So I took off a whole year, went over to Germany. I was hoping to interview these 20, maybe get another 5 or 10. In the first month alone, I interviewed over 30 people of Jewish descent serving in the Nazi military. And by the end of the year, I collected 200 interviews. And I had over 20,000 pages of documents. And it just kind of, it took on a life of its own. And a lot of these guys are not curious anomalies. So I'm just kind of going to go over a little bit of this, what this book, what I found, and kind of truth. So that's the title of my first book, Hitler's Jewish Soldiers. You know, the movie I just told you about, Peter Milius was the man who I met. And then, you know, where all my stuff are, you know, it's housed right now. It's in the German military archives. I have over, you know, 30,000 pages of documents now. And there are 3,000 photographs and hundreds of hours of videos. So what I found is my professor, who was brilliant, was making the false assumption quite often that Germany was actually groups. You had the Jews and the Nazis. But what you got to really look at is societies are relationships. People come together, you know, you bring a whole bunch of girls and guys together, before you know it, you're going to have mixed marriages left and right. And that's what's happening in Germany. And what people fail to look at is, okay, you had the Jews, 600,000 affiliating Jews in Germany, and then you had a lot of the Nazis who were voting and so on. But what happened to all those people of assimilation? And how Jewish did you have to be Jewish? You know, before Hitler, Judaism was really a religion. Once you converted, all was well. You could become a professor, a lawyer, a doctor. Suddenly with Hitler, it was a race. It was your blood. It was your phenotypical traits. And Hitler, a high school dropout, was the highest authority of genetics in the land, and he was influenced by Gregor Mendel, the monk, you know, green pea, yellow pea, green pea, thinking that you could inherit all your blood from one parent. So when he opened up the Pandora's box of racial laws, first the Aryan paragraph, saying if you had one or more non-Aryan grandparents, we need to get rid of you. Well, when that law came out in 1933, you had hundreds of thousands of people in the Nazi party, in the military, and business going, well, I have that. And then also the Japanese were bad. You know, hey, we're allied with you, and you're saying non-Aryans are bad. We're non-Aryans, you know. And then it was like, oh, well, you're the Aryans of the Asia. Of Asia. You know, so then the Nuremberg Laws came out. And they defined what a Jew was a person who had three or more Jewish grandparents or who practiced the Jewish religion. And then there was two new racial categories, half Jew, two Jewish grandparents, quarter Jew, one Jewish grandparent. And what was crazy is that these guys were forced to serve in the military. And if they were high-ranking officers, Hitler would look at them, and if they had blonde hair, good military track record, good background, he would actually Aryanize them. He would declare them of German blood. And with one, you know, signature of Hitler, he could make somebody a kosher Aryan. And Milk is an example. Milk is an example of that. He was second in command of the Luftwaffe, ran the Lufthansa. So, you know, you should have seen Henry Turner's face when I came back. This guy, Helmut Bilberg, he was the father of Blitzkrieg. World War I, he was the first guy to organize tanks, planes, artillery, infantry, and coordinated attacks. He was the first one to use radios and airplanes to communicate with troops on the ground in World War I. Russia and France wasn't even doing that at the outbreak of World War II. He was brilliant, and he was the father of Blitzkrieg. And I met the family, and they gave me his letters and diaries. I mean, it's kind of crazy what I was coming up with. The guy who had probably one of the biggest influences on Pearl Harbor, he captured a British steamship in 1940 that had detailed graphs and numbers of British war strength in East Asia, had detailed blueprints of Singapore's fortifications, had detailed a description of the poor defense of Hong Kong. Japan got all this information, and Hirohito and his generals upped the attack on Pearl Harbor by 6 months. You know, these guys are weak. So when I came back to Turner, and I started saying, hey, you're not curious anomalies. You had generals, field marshals, admirals. You know, and these guys, by questioning, finding truth, because one of the biggest questions in the 90s was, who knew about the Holocaust? And Goldhagen's book, who I mentioned, every German knew about the Holocaust. They were excited about it. They couldn't wait to shove their neighbors in the crematorium. So I'm thinking, hey, if you have a whole bunch of guys in the Nazi military, and the Nazi military is responsible for doing the Holocaust, wouldn't these guys be in a perfect position to really understand what was going on? And wouldn't they have a non-biased approach to it because they don't want their mothers and grandfathers and aunts and uncles and cousins and brothers and sisters to be thrown in the ovens? Then they wouldn't serve a nation to do that. Speaking of how you find truth and knowledge. And here's the Nuremberg Laws that you have. And this is what's interesting. Jewish law says if you have a Jewish mother, you're a Jew. So when I first started coming out with this, did any of you know who Simon Wiesenthal is? One of the greatest Nazi hunters, after the war. I went and met with him in Vienna. And he says, we Jews have enough problems, bury this. That's not truth. You know? It tells us something about history when it really happened about the human condition. You don't want to bury it because it might be embarrassing. And what's embarrassing is the Jewish law, which is actually interesting. Before Caesar Augustus, Jewish identity was strictly tribal. Tribe of Benjamin, tribe of Dan. In fact, if you read the Exodus from, or the Bible, there's a man that leaves with them, and he didn't have a Jewish father. But he had a Jewish mother from the tribe of Dan, and the tribe rejected him as not being Jewish, so he cursed God, and Moses had him stoned. But that was how identity was until you get to Caesar Augustus. And under Caesar Augustus, they didn't really understand very much. I mean, Aristotle thought that a woman was just a reservoir for the seed that we put in her, and that a child is really all from a man. I mean, they didn't understand about genetics. So, but they always knew who a mother might be, and you didn't always know who the father was. So Roman law said mothers determine citizenship, because a mom will always know who her child is. So Jewish law started changing at this time period, taking on the dominant law at the time, except for status. If you're a Cohen and Levi, priestly caste, you can only get that through your father. You get citizenship through your mother. Well, now when you look at Nazi Germany, and I'm saying Hitler's Jewish soldiers, a lot of these people who were very Jewish-oriented and very focused patriotic, like, they're not Jews. Oh, like, well, according to your racial laws, yes. You have more Jews in the Nazi military than you can believe, because 60% of all the half-Jews I documented had Jewish mothers, and 30% of the quarter Jews had Jewish mothers, and I interviewed a lot of people who were actually Jews in hiding. So it brings up all these interesting questions about identity. And, who is a Jew? Who is a victim? Who is a perpetrator? And so I got into the Nazi laws, and this is what's crazy. Quarter Jews and half Jews, by law, had to serve in the military. They didn't have a choice. So here I am, I have an Iron Cross, I come up, and my mom is taking me to the draft station, for the younger brother, older brother, me, they're already in uniform, and she's wearing a Jewish star. I go up to the Russian front, commanding four tanks, my mom sends a Theresienstadt. I mean, think of the weird dynamics here. Hitler always wanted side and front shots at people to see if they looked Jewish or not. And when he was Aryanizing, he Aryanized thousands. And if they looked too Jewish, he rejected them. And across the picture above in his file, this is Anton Meyer. It was written by one of Hitler's bureaucrats. Er sieht zu jüdisch aus. He looks too Jewish. So he was rejected. He committed suicide later in jail. This is a funny story. Werner Goldberg, he's on the front of my book as well. Goebbels, propaganda chief for Hitler, one of the most Aryan-looking soldier in Berlin in 1939. So he wrote a whole bunch of the battalions in the area. And Werner Goldberg won the competition. He was blonde, very blonde hair, blue eyes, and for the next 4 or 5 months he was touted around as the typical Aryan soldier until they found out his father was a Jew. This shows you how bogus the racial laws were. Any of you know about the Blaue Engel? Marlon Dietrich? All that music in there was written by Friedrich Hollander, his uncle. So every time this guy went into different units with that name, Hollander, which is a fairly common German name, but a lot of people at that time period, that was a famous film, and they just assumed he was Jewish, and then, unfortunately for him, when they asked him, he's like, yeah, that's my uncle. His uncle who did that music died in Auschwitz. And this guy had the equivalent of the Medal of Honor and commanded a whole regiment when he was in Russia. So, how do I get the next one up?
The other presentation?
Yeah, the other presentation. So, what this led me to believe, and what one of the most fascinating things, speaking of truth, is the prevailing concept of acknowledged it during the Third Reich in the 80s and 90s, was that everybody in Germany knew about it. What my research really, I think, was shocking to most Holocaust historians, and in that small little world of Holocaust historians, I made a huge mark, because I showed that these guys really did not know. Speaking of truth, you know, knowledge, experience, and witnessing is three different layers of how you get truth. So a lot of these guys knew it was bad to be Jewish, but they didn't know that being a Jew would equate later on to extermination. I mean, they didn't know that the guys they went to school with, their neighbors, many of their relatives, who were the Aryan branch, if you will, quote unquote, were going to be sticking their families in an oven. I mean, that was just beyond their knowledge. Now, they knew about concentration camps, Dachau, Buchenwald, Sachsenhausen, outside of Berlin, but that these camps were the stepping stones, because these were just forced labor camps, but these were the stepping stones to more horrible camps, Majdanek, Sobibor, Auschwitz, of extermination was beyond anything that they could comprehend in the society that they grew up in. I mean, think about it, this society, Wittgenstein, Nietzsche, Heine, Mendelssohn, Bach, Beethoven,
Goethe.
Yeah, this nation doesn't do these things. And the flip side of that is that if a nation like that can do it, what nation cannot? But on the flip side, the lack of knowing was actually fairly broad in German society. Now, granted, you step back, a lot of them didn't want to know. You know, they're being bombed, they're losing their husbands or brothers or sons in the war. They couldn't care less. Also, the concept of Judaism, this is another thing I think my book was fairly shocking for a lot of people. Hitler's view of a Jew, if you read Mein Kampf, is the ultra-Orthodox Jew. The beard, the sidewalks, the captain, and why did he hate this particular Jew the most? Well, let me back up to my experience in the Israeli military. If you follow Israeli politics, you'll find that the biggest growing segment demographically in Israeli society are the ultra-Orthodox. Average 7 kids per family. Women usually start having kids when they're 17 and 18 in that society. These ultra-Orthodox, they study all day. They don't work. They get welfare checks. They can vote, but they don't serve in the military. In a country where it's universal service, and also in a country that has 6 million Jews surrounded by a couple hundred million Arabs that hate them, you know, they can't afford not to have a strong military. So my drill sergeant one day, when he found out that I was studying the Holocaust, we were overlooking this huge complex in the desert, in the Negev, and it's huge, and it wasn't on any of the maps that we had when we were doing topography. I was like, where is this facility? He's like, that is where we do not have our nuclear weapons. And then we were talking about the Holocaust, and he's like, you know, had Hitler killed the Tosin, the ultra-Orthodox, they spit on the ground, this world would be a better place. Horrifying, but now get back to Hitler. Hitler served in World War I. He came from Vienna in Austria. A lot of these ultra-Orthodox did not serve. And so he's looking at them as parasites, they don't support, and he hated them. And that's, if you look at Mein Kampf, that's a lot of times the person that he's describing as a Jew. And a lot of German Jews couldn't stand what was called the Ostjuden, the Eastern Jew. Also what's kind of shocking about this time period is Hitler experienced the horrible civil war, as most Germans did, after World War I. People don't realize Germany was shredded after World War I, 1918-1919, by civil war. Thousands of people died because they were either the Freikorps, the Nationalists for Germany, or they're part of the Spartacists, they're part of the Communists. And this Red Scare, there was a huge mutiny in the Navy at the very end of the war from Kiel and Bremerhaven. There were the Reds. So Hitler's looking at all this chaos that's been created in my country was from the Communists. Who created communism? Karl Marx, a Jew. So this is where Hitler's primitive mindset was, of hating Jews. So a lot of these guys who I documented who were of Jewish descent, they're thinking, you know, when Hitler's talking about get rid of the Jew, they're not talking about us. They're talking about those ultra-Orthodox. They're talking about the commies. We hate them too. And for the first like 2 or 3 years, you had a lot of Jewish groups, Jewish veteran groups, that were supporting Hitler. So this history kind of showed that, you know, nothing's black and white. There's a lot more gray. And that the ability to really comprehend what's going on a high-level strategic level in your society, especially back then, was very difficult to ascertain. And the irony here is that most of these half-Jews who served bravely, had Hitler continued to war one, they would have been killed. And they didn't even know that. And they were starting to be so. So that's one part of speaking of truth, how you get the truth. I, you know, wasn't expecting to find all this stuff when I went to that theater. But I let it kind of take me on this journey. And I can't tell you how many people along the way told me not to do it. And, you know, this book, as a history book, it's in 16 languages and it sold 70,000 copies, which for a history book is just crazy. You know, only sell 3 to 5 and you're happy. And I will say this about Henry Turner. When the book came out and I got the awards, Yale threw me a big party. And I went there, and when I saw on the invitee list that Henry Turner was on it, I was like, oh, you know, because each one was supposed to say something about me. And I was like, yeah, what's he going to, he's gonna kill me, you know. And I was like, well, I can handle it now. I got hopefully enough people there to support me. But he did get up, and he took the book, and you could tell it was very worn. He had marked up a whole bunch of pages. He had little notes later on that he later asked me about. But he got up in front of everybody and says, I want to just let you know that I'm glad Brian did not listen to me. Because if he had listened to me, this first rate of historical scholarship would have never been written. So speaking of truth, what I found is a lot of times when people tell you not to do something, it's up to you to figure out if they're right.
Mm-hmm.
Not listen to them. Be a contrarian. You know, continually be skeptical. Continue on questioning. And you can never know enough. I mean, the Third Reich and Nazi Germany, you thought everything was written about it, you know? And I find this whole field that nobody looked at. And just put it in context, probably from the assimilation records, birth rates, draft letters, and the discharge numbers that I got, 90,000 half-Jews, 60,000 quarter-Jews, and probably about 5,000 full-Jews served in the Nazi military during World War II. Bigger than our United States Marine Corps today, you know? And I interviewed, I had 400 there, but eventually I did some more interviews after this book came out. It's now at 500 interviews, and when I stopped, I had 600 people waiting for me, and I documented by name and rank over 2,000. So, during this research, speaking of how you get truth and whatnot, I'm going to kind of talk about the next book, and that is Rescued from the Reich. And I came across this fascinating story of this rabbi here, who's rescued by one of these guys that Hitler Aryanized, named Ernst Bloch. I think that's kind of strange. You know, Nazi soldiers don't usually rescue rabbis. And what's interesting about historical research is I wrote this as my undergraduate essay with Paul Hyman, one of the few people that believed in me at Yale. She was head of Jewish studies there. She's one of the foremost experts of Jewish women's studies. She's one of those tough, wonderful people that made you inspired. You know, it could push you more, and I loved being with her, and she believed in me. And she said, Brian, go look into this. So as an undergrad, I went to the National Archives in Washington, D.C., looked into it, all my stuff. She's like, you're the first undergrad to go to the National Archives to find this out. So I wrote an essay, and it became my master's, and it became my first book with Yale University Press, book with Yale University Press, the second book. And then when this came out, I had 6 key characters in this book's family get in touch with me and give me their family archives. Now, to write this first book, which is about 400 pages, I went to archives in Riga, archives in Stockholm, archives in Germany, archives in America, and I did over 60 interviews with people. And read, of course, a lot of books to find what this remarkable rescue was. It's how our U.S. government worked with the Nazi Secret Service in 1939-1940 to rescue the highest-ranking rabbi, Orthodox rabbi, with Chabad, Lubavitch, out from underneath the nose of the SS, because they were killing rabbis when they took over Poland, and get him to America through Latvia, Sweden, Baltic Sea, North Sea, and to America. Now, the largest Hasidic community, ultra-Orthodox community in the world is based out of Brooklyn, New York. So, you know, this Lubavitcher is kind of the, if you learn more about this guy, in the group is called the Lubavitch, they're called Chabad, ultra-Orthodox, it's, you know how Christianity happened. They really are a remnant of that old branch of Christianity, if you will, of this messianic focus, this very superstitious, very mystical type of Judaism. And I go into the history here. This is the guy that we're talking about who was rescued. So think about this fascinating dynamic. And I was talking to some of my Yale professors, and Paula Hyman was very supportive, but everybody else thought this was a crazy, this didn't happen. Our U.S. government didn't work do this. I'm finding Cordell Hull and FDR knew about this. And uncustomarily, you know, if you know about the St. Louis debacle, the refugee ship that came to us, and we kicked them back, and one third of them all died in the Holocaust, that Cordell Hull and FDR signed off on this and rescued this guy is crazy. And they actually worked with the Nazi Secret Service to do it. You know, it kind of goes against everything you understand about history. And I mean, what's fascinating is the Nazi soldiers who were earmarked to rescue them were sent up to Poland, and they were going around the streets of Warsaw, going up to ultra-Orthodox Jews saying, "Hey, where is the rabbi? We want to rescue him." Yeah, sure you do. And they had to convince him. You know, so the war happens, 25% of the city is bombed to the ground. And here's Hull's State Department letter to the American Embassy saying, "Joseph Nizakshirsen, to my knowledge, I was the first one to really find this document. Let's get this guy out." Why is he doing this? Well, Brandeis, Coolidge, Hoover, Senator Robert Wagner and so on had met this rabbi in 1929 on a goodwill tour in America because we had saved him from Stalin from being executed. Stalin was persecuting all these religious leaders. And there's a lot of Jews in America that were of this ilk, Chabad. When he was captured by Stalin and going to be killed, they all went to the government and they really made their presence felt. And these people took it to the president. The president decided to act on it. Rebbe came to the States, met a whole bunch of these people. Then in 1939, all these people who knew him went back to the president and said, "Hey, this guy has a lot of clout here, the Jewish vote, you know." So they're not doing the right thing because it was the right thing to do. They were doing it because of political pressure. But it still happened. Abel Canaris was the head of the German Secret Service that was, I mean, can you imagine he's getting all these calls? Okay, how do we fight Russia? How do we take over Poland? I'm going to fight France. I want to rescue a rabbi. Because he's getting this from the four-year plan under Goering, Helmut Boltot. And he's like, "Okay, I think I have a guy. Ernst Gluck." He had taken a bayonet up through his chin and into his skull, dividing his face vertically in the Battle of Ypres in 1915. He was left for dead for a couple of days, and when they were bulldozing all the dead bodies, one screamed out. It was him. Had several surgeries, went back to the Western Front, served two more years as an infantry officer, and got the equivalent of 5 Purple Hearts, a Bronze Star, and a Silver Star. I mean, he was a warrior. And what's fascinating is when my first book came out, one of his kids died. I've met 4 of them. And this is all talking about history and truth and identity. This is a beautiful story on the side. Mm-hmm. One of the sons was very hard to talk to. He was traumatized because at the end of the war, Ernst Bloch stayed with his troops to defend Berlin from the Russians. He was a Prussian soldier through and through, never leave a man behind, even though he was serving a nation that had given an oath to Hitler. And he was half Jewish. And he sent his family to the West. They survived. But they look at him as, "You were a Nazi and you abandoned us and you died for what?" And the kids were very traumatized. One's a Buddhist monk in California, woman. One's an OBGYN in Hamburg. She wants to give life instead of take it because of her father. Another one was a government official in the German government, very helpful to me, Christian. And he gave me a lot of stuff, and he wanted to make a good German government instead of a bad one. And then he had this other guy that was a diplomat in France, and he was traumatized with this and hated his father. He never would talk to me, even though I had this book out. But he died soon after the first book came out. And his son, who believed in me, found a huge chest of over 300 letters Bloch had written during the war. And when this book came out and all the evidence came out, and I had shown a lot to the kids, the OBGYN sat with tears in her eyes, finding out that her father, yes, a brave warrior, but also was compassionate and was responsible for saving literally dozens of Jewish lives. She's like, you've given me my father. You've given me somebody I can be proud of, with tears in her eyes. So speaking about truth, knowledge, looking underneath the hood, instead of just assuming something, you can go into it, look into it, and see what you find. So Block is picked to go find the Rebbe. He convinces him. He gets him out of Poland. Remarkable circumstances get him out. There's a huge library he helps rescue to for the Rebbe. And this is what's interesting. I find in this story that these Nazi officers, if you will, are really true heroes, Canaris and Block. They're dealing with a very bad situation. Nobody foresaw Auschwitz in 1939. There's an interesting book called The Twisted Road to Auschwitz. It was never a foregone conclusion, even though Hitler had exterminationist vocabulary in Mein Kampf. He never was thinking of how to really slaughter everybody. They wanted to get rid of them with immigration. They wanted to just force them out of the country. And then all of a sudden, when they took over Russia, and they had all these Jews, they're like, all right, we've got to kill them. And they were ultra-Orthodox. So these guys were doing the best with what they had. But the guy who they rescued, the Rebbe, who I've been showing you, was a religious racist. He said, all the other Jews, especially the assimilated ones, they're causing the Holocaust. They're the traitor. They're the ones that should be killed. They're the ones that should be going in the ovens. He's saying this all the time. Instead of trying to find ways to unite people, going, hey, you know, we're all Jews here. We're all citizens of democracy. Let's find a way to try to prevent this. And trying to bond people together. Instead of that, you find out that he actually turns out to be one of the most nastiest people in this story. And he should have, you gotta get the feeling, why did we spend so much effort to rescue him? You know, and he's a horrible human being. So here, this great Jewish sage supposedly, is supposedly the, you know, going to be the hero. You find out you don't like him, and you end up liking the Nazis that rescued him and the things they did. I talk about how they escaped as the ship that they went on. These are some of the propaganda of the Rebbe. And now, it's like I said, this is his son-in-law and his second cousin. There's a lot of incest in Hasidic communities until very recently. They thought the greatest man had this wonderful spirit, and they also knew the wealth of a family, if you kept it within the family, was stronger. So to keep that spirit strong and to keep the wealth strong, they felt like you got to marry your cousins. So that's why the taste acts in the ultra-Orthodox community is very high. And other genetic deformities. They're stopping to do that now for obvious reasons, but the last time they did not. So his second cousin and his son-in-law got rescued from Vichy, France in 1940 because of his rescue. His father-in-law, who was taken out to Rebbe, and now through him, this became one of the huge, biggest Jewish communities in the world. They're like the Jewish Mormons, because they go out and they do proselytize. These two guys, at the end of the war, I told you about Block, he gets killed. Canaris gets sent to a concentration camp because of his anti-Hitler activities. A few days before the war ends, he's hung up by piano wire, nude, and then his body is taken and incinerated over a pile of logs in front of all the inmates. That's what happened to the two great heroes. There is a movement to try to get them on the righteous Gentile path at Yad Vashem in Israel. So, you know, I look at the questions of truth, you know, complexity of history and morals, complexity of choices in dangerous times, complexity of looking at troubling times from comfortable chairs. You know, and I ask, so hopefully, a lot of just tough questions in my books. When people die in the world, what can we do? When people die in the world, what should we do? When people die in the world, should we care? And so what kind of action should come with caring? What have you done lately for your fellow man? As a Marine Corps officer, I'd be very happy to go in if I know a whole bunch of ISIS soldiers are opposite me and they had raped women and killed Yazidis. I'll kill them. And we got to have a society that's like that. I wish we were all about love and peace and democracy and having debates. But the one language people really understand is violence, and we have to do it. I wish we didn't, because war is amoral, and so these are also two breasts in my souls. On one side, I don't want to take another life. You know, that is my brother. Genetically, we now know we're all related. You know, we look back at the Human Genome Project. But on the other side, if we don't have the wherewithal to go forward and kill bad people, Hitler and Hirohiko and others would have reigned supreme. So there's also truth. How do we create a just society with a violent component to it? You know, if you want peace, prepare for war. So I'll leave this question, and I'll tell you the last thing that I don't usually look for controversy, but I always tend to get it. Because this ultra-Orthodox community threatened me with lawsuits, threatened me with, a few of them actually threatened me with physical harm. And I said, come on, you know, most of these yeshiva boys, they're not going to be able to hurt me. They might shoot me, but, you know, they were threatening me. I was like, come on, you know, they're like, why are you doing this? You know, why don't you threaten me with your pen? Let me see your evidence. Because I went to them. I said, please tell me if this is wrong, what I'm saying about your Rebbe. They couldn't handle it, you know. And it was weird. I was getting from this really Jewish religious group some of the most mafia-like behavior that I ever had. When I started doing Hitler's Jewish Soldiers, a lot of the society, like Henry Turner, didn't think I was going to find anything, didn't take me seriously at all. And it was controversial until the book came out and people saw the evidence. And they're like, wow, we never really knew that there was this huge group of people that nobody really focused on. How many people focus on half blacks, half whites, half Catholic, half Protestant, you know, half Jewish? These are kind of weird concepts, hyphenated humanity. But that's what Hitler was all about, splitting up humanity, but they never focused on this group. So now to the last kind of controversial thing that I've uncovered in my fifth book. If you watched the Super Bowl last year, the man who flipped the coin for the game was named Woody Williams. He's a Marine Corps Medal of Honor recipient from Iwo Jima, still alive, 95 years old. And I was on the island of Iwo Jima 3 years ago with him, and I heard him talking about his stories and how he incinerated all these Japanese with his flamethrower and pushed the battle forward on Iwo Jima, and how one-third of all Japanese who died on Iwo Jima died by being incinerated because they were in the island, they were on top of it. So the only way to get to them is to burn them. We use 360,000 gallons of flamethrower fuel on the Japanese to kill 20,000 men. 7,000 of those were burned alive. So I'm hearing this story. I'm like, man, this is a crazy story. 90% fatality rate with flamethrowers because their battle signature is so big. You know, half diesel, half aviation octane fuel. When you start flaming it up, you have a big black cloud hanging over you. You're carrying 100 pounds of deer, bracketing you with mortars, or hitting you with grenades, or shooting you is a fairly easy target. And so these guys were very brave. So I was like, this might be worthy of a book. Nobody's written a very good book. In fact, nobody's written a thoroughly documented biography of an enlisted man of the Marine Corps from World War II. You have a few guys that were, you know, high-ranking officers like Chesty Puller, Happy Boynton, remember Bob Black Sheep, a few others, but nobody focused on the enlisted man. There were 600,000 Marines that served in World War II. Right now, the Marine Corps is 200,000, the biggest our Marine Corps has ever been. We had six divisions. And we really were one of the main thrusts into Japan. So I was like, this is going to be interesting. And he's a Medal of Honor. Put it into context, 16.3 million people served in the United States military in World War II. 476 got the Medal of Honor. And here's one of them. 84 Marines got it. He's one of them. 57%, 60% basically of all people who got the Medal of Honor did it. What they did to get it, they died. They got it posthumously. So to meet a guy in his 90s that got that medal, it was truly remarkable. So I said, okay, this might be worthy of a book. Well, as I dug into it, I found that half the stuff that was reported that he did to warrant his officers to send up the chain of command to get Truman to award him the Medal of Honor, he didn't do. And when you look back at how that information got into the chain of command, it was from a young kid, him, shooting his mouth off. And through telephone, taking on a life of its own and becoming truth. Like me telling you, hey, yeah, I was in Afghanistan, I killed 40 people. He said, hey, Rick killed 50 people. Oh, wow, man, did you hear Rick killed 200 people? You know, it all stems from my exaggeration, but a lot of times that 200 people was really coming from Woody himself. So all of a sudden, at the beginning of this research project, I was working with Woody, but he thought I was going to do a hagiography, that I was going to be just spellbound just like everybody else, because there's this weird reverence for a Medal of Honor person in our society. Generals are supposed to salute them, and they do. And these guys, they are not questioned. Why not? Well, I have Jewish roots. You know, I have a lot of chutzpah, a lot of questions. Get into it. I find a lot of stuff doesn't happen according to the way that he thought it, you know, was going to, from a book perspective. And I find truth. You know, this is what's fascinating. When I interviewed all these German guys, veterans, and I went back to their military files, I rarely found any discrepancies. Because most of these guys I interviewed, first time they were interviewed was by me. So they didn't have a chance to evolve their stories. Also, they served for a nation that lost. So there's not a lot of people that are really gung-ho to hear their military war stories. They also served Hitler. So it's not something they're very proud about. So what I found is that most of the stories I got from German veterans, Nazis, if you will, were accurate and true. I've interviewed 30 Marines from Iwo Jima. Almost every one of them I found discrepancies and lies and sea tales, as we say, that are huge. I mean, we're not talking about little discrepancies about, you know, I fired 4 magazines in one day versus 3. We're talking about one guy who was his best friend, was supposedly there when he got the medal. I found out he made up the whole story. As soon as he hit the beach, he had shell shock. He broke down psychologically. They had to remove him from the island. And for the last 50 years, 60 years, he's been telling everybody how great he was. He was up in front of Senator Franken to get medals for bogus stories. And the review board in Washington, D.C. for medals was looking at him. And World War II Museum and the History Channel was about to do a 2-week extravaganza with Woody Williams, the guy who had a documenting Medal of Honor, to do a whole documentary of their lives in the Pacific. This whole story was made up. And I'm finding it here. American heroes. Marines. I'm a Marine. Honor, courage, commitment. We don't lie, cheat, or steal, or tolerate those who do. I'm finding that as a Marine, I'm having to come forward and say, you know what? We got a lot of liars. We got a lot of people who create a bogus story. Now, I had a 3-star, a 4-star, and a 1-star. Brigadier General, a Lieutenant General, and a General tell me to bury this. Do not write this. I was like, it's the truth. So I don't care. These people are still alive. I was like, even more so. You know, what happened to our creeds? Honor, courage, the truth. I couldn't believe it, what I was hearing. So I'm going to write this. But this is not the end of this debacle. So the Japanese general who we fought on Iwo Jima, his name is Kuribayashi. He's seen Flags of Our Fathers and letters from Iwo Jima. He's highlighted very prominently in these films. So what do? I write his grandson, who's a prominent politician in Shinzo Abe's government. He's like the number 10th guy in the cabinet. He's earmarked to be the next prime minister. And I'm part of the Iwo Jima American Association here. And he has very strong ties with that. So I wanted to interview him about his family and whatnot. So I go over there, arrange professional interpreters and so on. I sit down. And what a lot of people don't know about Kuribayashi is he was second in command of the army, the 23rd Army, that attacked Hong Kong in December 1941. And if you've heard a little bit about rape of Nanking, you can also say the rape of Hong Kong. Within a couple of years, you had 50,000 civilians that were slaughtered by the Japanese and at least 2,000 rapes. Not as bad as Nanking, 300,000 civilians killed and 20,000 rapes, but still, it shows the horrible behavior of the Japanese. Put it in context with Nazi Germany. Nazi Germany slaughtered about 11.7 million people. 6 million Jews, 3.3 million Russian POWs, and a host of a lot of others. Jehovah Witnesses, gays, socialists, etc. Japan, I estimate minimum 22 million people they killed.
Twice as many.
About 17, 18 million of those are Chinese. A lot of people even put it up higher to 40 million because they had developed a bubonic strand that was so deadly it could kill you within 24 hours. And what they would do is they would put 20,000 fleas infected with this bubonic plague in a clay bomb. They'll parachute it over a small village of, you know, 5,000-10,000 people, and the next day they'd all be dead. And right before the war ended with the Bangalans, they released all of their rats and their fleas on the population and left. And there was a massive, hundreds of thousands of people died in August and September and October. Grotesque human beings, this Japanese culture. So, this guy is really high up with my organization. I got three-star generals who are leading this organization. I get a personal meeting with this guy, and as a historian, as a Jew, you know, a person who speaks for victims, I'm thinking, okay, I got to ask him about Hong Kong, but I got to do it respectfully, and I got to hear his thoughts. So I basically just said, hey, a lot of troubling things, you have to really be careful with the Japanese, a lot of troubling things happen in Hong Kong. How do we present this? How do we deal with this? Well, either A, he was shocked that I knew he knew, or B, he's been flying high in the political spectrum after these movies of Clint Eastwood, because he's gotten so much political capital out of this. He has posters all over the place with a picture of his grandfather and him. I defend Japan just like my grandfather. He's one of those big war hawks, if you will, taking all those islands from China and protecting the South China Sea. And he's also been one of the biggest ones trying to get the Kuril Islands back from Russia. So he's a big, it's a liberal party, but he's very conservative. So after this questioning, and I had sent all my questions to his advisors, they did not brief him on it, apparently. I came back, he's trying to get me removed from the board, he's trying to have censorship, he's having people from Washington, D.C., the embassy calling me up, telling me I am not allowed to print his stuff because he didn't give me permission. I'm like, wait a second, I asked him questions and he really gave me answers, and he gave me some really good answers that I think I took him off guard. Talk about manifest destiny and how Japan shouldn't be crucified for what India, or what Britain was doing to India, and what France was doing to Vietnam. And all these things that are pretty politically charged, but very interesting statements. Gives me insights into his grandfather and him. He's a samurai as well. And I think somebody sat down and was like, you can't have him, a gringo, write about you this way. It's going to hurt you politically. And also, Hong Kong thing really stirred him up. And so I had a publisher, two publishers actually, Regnery Press, which I couldn't deal with because they were too conservative. But I had that press, and I had University Press of Kansas. They were so worried about the political outfall of this, they wouldn't publish the book. Even though they both admitted this is truth, that my documentation was impeccable. Now I went to Potomac Books, I went to Stockpole, and I have a couple other academic presses that I'm going to be able, my books are going to come out in November. And that's when I'm going to be doing it under a pseudonym of David Alkay. So they'll come to his house in my neighborhood and not mine. But speaking of truth, a lot of times people, you know, kind of like the whole Jack Nicholson phrase from A Few Good Men, you can't handle the truth. It's like history is all about finding the truth, but a lot of times when you look into it, as Michael Barabaum told me, one of a mentor of mine, he wrote The World Must Know, he's a famous Holocaust historian, he says, quite often when you get into the truth, it's hard. It's difficult. It's something that challenges us at our very core being, because the truth is not pretty quite often. And we want simple, beautiful stories. So with that being said, it's, you know, my quest as a historian is I do follow Henry Turner's process of empiricism. I do try to find this ball of clay and try to get it, give it form as I find more and more evidence. I do have a reputation as being an archive rat. If you look at my first book, The Other Jewish Soldiers, when I gave it to my publisher, it had 400 pages of footnotes and citations and 300 pages of text. Kansas said, Brian, in the history of publishing, we've never published a book with more footnotes than text. Cut it down, which I have. But I've really focused on the source material, trying to weigh evidence against interest. As a Marine Corps officer with this last one, my interest would be, hoorah, great Marine Corps warrior, look at him go, he'll sell books. Same thing with this Rebbe. If I had a great rabbi story, he's a wonderful person, if I laid out all that other ugly stuff about him, I would have had the entire Jewish Hasidic community buying my books. And I would have been the darling. They even threatened me. They bribed me with that. If you do this, we'll make sure you have a couple hundred speaking lecture circuits already, you know, lined up, and we'll give you $1,000 to $2,000 per speaking engagement honorarium. Yeah, 100 speaking, okay, $2,000. I mean, as an academic, when I was getting, you know, $30,000 from AMU, you know, I was like, no, evidence, interest. You know, I can at least look myself in the mirror and say, okay, I did the best with what I had. And quite often, all my books, it's not pretty. It's very interesting. People love watching other people fight. You know, so that's kind of been my quest of truth, if you will. And so I'll open it up to questions.
Yeah. Wow. I got a quick question here. I don't know.
Sure.
You don't have to answer this because it could get way off topic, but what do you think of Holocaust denial?
Okay, Holocaust denial. Oh, you know what? I'm taking off my jacket, and do I need this for the recording?
You need to stick it somewhere on you.
Holocaust denial, you know, it's, to me, I've always said, and I don't want to be flippant here, but you have to either be very evil or very stupid or both to be a Holocaust denier. There is a wonderful movie that just came out about the David Irving trial, and I encourage you to look at that. It's called Denial. And it's a phenomenal movie. What happened was, David Irving was a great historian. He was also not really accepted in the establishment because he was English born, but he didn't get into the great schools. He never got a college degree. But he was working over in Germany, and he started writing about some people who he bounced into, some very prominent individuals from the Nazi hierarchy. And he started writing some articles, and he started writing some books. And what he would do is he'd go to these widows or go to the families of some of these high-ranking individuals and say, you know, everything they're saying about your husband or everything they're saying about your father is all wrong. You give me your documents, I'll write it up. And he wrote a great biography of Goering, a great biography of Rommel, and so on. And he even wrote an interesting book about German war in Russia. They started tweaking things along the way, saying Hitler may not knew about everything, maybe didn't order it, you know, the Holocaust maybe didn't even really happen. David Irving, he's the man, most famous. And this guy, I mean, he was with mainstream presses, Vintage, Little Brown, Norton, Viking. I mean, we're not talking about some throwaway historian. I mean, people were citing him in works left and right. They started doing stuff like this, and Deborah Lipshot, a Holocaust historian at Emory University, basically wrote about it and said, this guy's a Holocaust denier, he's a quack, you know, and you know, we shouldn't listen to him, and nobody should cite him. He's a reject. He is also immoral. So David Irving sued her in a British court. And unlike even though we inherit parliamentary law, we have a little bit different system. Us, you're innocent instead of proving guilty. Over there, you're guilty until you can prove your innocence. So she had to go defend herself. Steven Spielberg paid for her legal fees. And during the trial process, what was fascinating is instead of him attacking her for libel, he all of a sudden was on the defense proving his historical methods for truth. And they found that he cited sources that didn't even exist in the archives. He'd do folder 75, you know, section 2. And then they would write the archive in Dresden. Can we see that folder? It doesn't exist. He made it up. Also, he was tweaking things. Like one document I know very well. In fact, I was asked by Richard Evans, who was one of the key guys helping Deborah Lipshot with the information, because this is one of the main documents I had. Hitler said, we're going to deal with the half-Jews after the war. After we kill all the Jews, we'll kill the half-Jews then, because we can't have the kids running around after we win this war. But he's talking about the Mischling. Well, David Irving, showing you how truth got distorted with this schmuck, he says, Hitler is going to deal with all the Jews after the war. He takes the half-Jews and says, all the Jews, and he then ignores the other little segment in the document where Hitler says, after we kill all the parents, then we'll have to kill the children, the half-Jews. So he tweaks it a little bit. So through that process, he was the archbishop of Holocaust denial, and then when that trial happened, he was destroyed. So you have a little fringe of enemies to other people. It's also in the Islamic world, you see, actually a Faustian kind of turmoil. On one side, a lot of these Islamic fascists will say, Hitler should have killed them all, killed more of them. Then the other side will say, Jews just made this story up to get money from Germany. You know? Like, well, wait a second, which one do you believe? So, you know, thank you for your question, it's warranted. But right now, there is not any real credible evidence at all for any of these guys to be able to come out with a story that has any plausibility that Hitler wasn't involved, didn't know about it, or that there wasn't at least 5.8 million. The reason why it gets wrapped up to over 6 million is because a lot of the infants and women who were pregnant at 8 and 9 months were never documented. And when you do extrapolations of demographics, there were a lot of infants that get you up over 6 million. Then if you take women who were 8 or 9 months pregnant, the child would be viable, you get like 6.4 million. This is the horrifying stat. It makes me almost cry when I think about this. Auschwitz, 1.5 million people get slaughtered there. And you basically are looking at around 400,000 of those 1.5 million are children under the age of 10. Under the age of 10, 400,000. And there's this one scene where they're about to go in the gas chamber, and this grandfather has this little boy, and he's bawling, just grabbing their leg, he's scared. And the grandfather reaches down, and says a few warm things, and gets the little boy laughing. And they go that way to the gas chamber, holding his grandfather's hand. He's going to take care of me. It's so hard for me with the German, I'm proud of my German heritage on one side, you know, I have a Jewish background, you know, and had I been there, they would have killed me. But you look at all the goodness and the law, the rest, you know, the process of law that came out of Germany and the thought, you know, there's a land of Dicta and Dinka, you know, thinkers and poets, and that this crazy nutcase, also very brilliant, Hitler, comes on the scene and can maneuver them within 12 years to do this. It just, you know, here again, it shows us the line between the truth here, the line between barbarity and civility is very small. And everything we see around here one day, ladies and gentlemen, will be a war zone. Unfortunately, it will be a war zone. It has been one, whether it be the Comanches and Apaches slaughtering each other, Civil War, that's a little bit more east of Texas, but we had a battle. It seems like that's going to happen. I mean, think about the Roman Empire one time, like, hey, we're never going to go away. Oh, Vandals, who are they? You know? And the Greek Empire, unfortunately, you know, man's inhumanity to man is something that's universal. The more we can fight against it and push it off and protect our democracy, I hope I'm wrong. History tells me I'm right. I hope I'm wrong.
A question, getting back to history, and these egregious, you know, wrong history, false history, makeup history, we know about. But every historian writes from a point of view. He's got all of his baggage, you know, his culture behind him that he brings to his craft. Whether he's right or not, you know, and gosh, what if we read American history from the point of view of a Native American? Wow. So what, you know, as a historian, would you comment on how a historian can be really objective? You know, can he stand back and really be completely objective?
Well, you know, as we were talking earlier, I had one of my wonderful teachers that mentored me at the Hope Center Academy call up, and we talked a little bit, and he was a big proponent of Moby Dick and kind of Herman Melville, and there's a line that always comes forward in my head when I'm thinking about history, that, you know, history is a continually evolving thing. It's a growing thing. Truth changes all the time. You know, and we got to be open to that. And I love what Melville said in his book. He's basically criticizing religion here, but you can also say history, when people are very convinced of what they know. And then the phrase is, those who think they're a possession of absolute truth are standing on the shoulders of salamander giants. You know, when you think you have the truth, you stop to grow. And as this mentor of mine said, you know, you got to be always open that things are wrong. And what I do, you know, I don't believe in objectivity in regards to what, you know, Rand followers believe. We're two chromosomes away from the chimpanzee, and it shows. Our adrenal glands are too big, our frontal lobes are too small, unfortunately. And so when I do history, you got to be always open that it's going to change. And what I do that I think is kind of unique compared to a lot of historians, and I think it's helped me get more truth than the average Joe, is a lot of people are very personal about their writing. It's an attack when somebody criticizes their writing. They get very upset. I love criticism. And David, by the way, and he helped me with my book that I'm writing right now. He wrote, he started reading, he's like, this is bad. You got to work on this. You know, I like this, but this is, it's good. It's good feedback. He's my friend. I trust him. He's also smart. He's written books as well. But going out and doing that, and I do that by the hundreds, because this is how I think. My first book, Hitler's Dear Soldiers, I had over 120 people who I met in trains, met at universities, who were my teachers along the way in my life, that when I got the book, they always expressed interest in Hitler's Dear Soldiers. I said, hey, when you get that, let me know. So I wrote all of them. I finally had my PhD working thesis. I said, hey, you remember that research I was doing? You said you'd be interested in looking at it? Can I send you a copy of it? I had over 90 say yes. So I would send 5 out at a time, get the feedback, redo the book, send out another 5. And I'm thinking to myself, you know what? The average age of these people who are sending 50, 60. So I just tapped into, if you think about it, I tapped into hundreds and hundreds of years, centuries of research and knowledge and experience that I could never do, no matter how hard I work in their libraries. And they were giving me interesting insights, new sources, different books to look at. And when I brought that first book out, Hitler's Dear Soldiers, you're looking at probably over 1,000 years of reading and experience that went into that book. Because I'm going to these people, I'm like, help me. Where am I wrong? And some of them, it might be one or two things. Hey, you misspelled this guy's name. You know, some others are like, hey, this is a wrong fact. You know, it wasn't 396 airplanes that attacked Pearl Harbor. We now know it's 350, which was something I just got. So these little things just crash that history and gets it better. Because I love the biblical proverb, he is wise who seeks counsel. And I love that with my writing. In fact, this is Philosophical Club. If any of you are up for reading a book on World War II, the Pacific War, the Holocaust, and Woody Williams, I have a working draft. If you want me to send it to you, we'd love to get the feedback.
No commercials. we have, gosh, they want us to get out of here. One more question to keep the answer short.
Really interesting. I appreciate this. I've just been to Jerusalem, and I've been to Auschwitz and Mauthausen and some of those. So yeah, I do like, what do you mean denying the whole Holocaust? It's crazy. I also just saw the movie Europa Europa.
Yeah.
So the topic is very, very timely for me. But I do have a question about that in the book, in the movie. The young man, when he's in this boarding school for young Nazis coming up, he's interested in this young woman and starts dating her, and she's kind of seducing. But the mom knows that he's Jewish, that the young girl doesn't. So she dumps him, and she goes and gets herself pregnant to give the baby to
Hitler.
To Hitler. Mm-hmm. And I know that movies sometimes they tweak some of this stuff for the sake of the movie, but is that true? Did that actually happen at that time?
Well, you have this thing called Lebensborn. And they had whole dormitories where they would take a beautiful young blonde lass, you know, 14, 15, 16, who wanted to give a father to the fatherland. Also, they had kind of takes brothels in Normandy. They think, in Norway, they think about 200,000 people are offspring of this, where they actually had birthing factories. So Lily, you know, Sholo Burrell's girlfriend, I don't know if she really did that or not, because a lot of the times the Germans of prominent Nazi families and whatnot were not going to do that. It was usually lower brow, and she was of a higher caliber. I think Shlomo, here again, I brought Shlomo Burrell to Yale to speak. I spent several days with him. I translated his book, and at the very end, he used somebody else, a professional translator. It probably was a lot better than mine, but he had had me do it. But when I looked into it, I think one reason why he went away from me is because I started finding out all these discrepancies in his story that didn't make sense. And this is probably one of them. Lily did not go to Lebensborn. She went off and, you know, she was with a Panzer officer. And, you know, she wanted to get married. She had married several other guys.
So it was Hollywood, huh?
Well, no, it's Shlomo Burrell making up stories. Because it sounds cool. You know, it sounds better. Now, there were ladies that were doing this, but most often what the Nazis looked at, they looked at Norwegian and Scandinavian. They were trying to get those women in. And a lot of times they were looking at the lower echelons of society. Women who came from broken homes, didn't have a family structure. Hey, you come in here. We have a whole community that takes care of you. You can have a family. You can have a kid that loves you, and so on. And they did hundreds of thousands. They believe there's probably over 1 million throughout Europe that were conceived this way.
I'm sorry, but they're going to kick us out of here. Okay. But I, you know, we didn't give enough time for everybody. So everybody, you're welcome to come and talk to Brian, you know, one-on-one, and he'll be glad to regale you. So, yeah. Thank you. Thank you very much.